Good day, everyone. Welcome to the CSU Relentless Gardener Podcast. I am Colorado State University Horticulture Specialist Linda Langelo, and today, Yvette Henson, Director of CSU Extension in San Miguel County. Let's get to the heart of it, where we explore the horticultural topic of changes in an extension career spanning 19 years, a look back. Hello, Yvette. How are you?
I'm good, Linda. How are you?
Good. Glad you could join me today. So, just off the top of your head, the changes that you have seen over the years. Let's start with, you know, your career. How did you start?
How did I start? So, I was what they call the non-traditional student. So I did go to college when everybody goes to college, but I didn't graduate. I got married and had three kids. And then I was like, you know, I really do want to get that degree because I want to have a job that's fulfilling and, you know, something I'm interested in. So I got a degree in horticulture. And so then we moved from Louisiana back to Colorado, where I'm from. And I worked for a little while I did various things. We live remotely then, and we still live remotely now in southwestern Colorado. So there's not as many opportunities over here as there are on the Front Range. But I went back to school and got my master's degree at CSU. And by then, two of our daughters had actually gone on to college themselves. And our youngest daughter was with us in Fort Collins. So, and then I applied for and got this job that I have now in the San Miguel Basin with CSU Extension, which was, you know, like a dream job. And not only that, but it's in the county where I was born. And so it's been such a joy to serve the people and the land. I like to think that I actually serve the land, that we do that, not just the people.
Right. What a great story. So I guess one of your most popular types of gardening was perennial gardens when you were getting your bachelor's degree.
Yeah, when I was getting my bachelor's degree. If you've been gardening any amount of time, you will remember that perennial gardening was all the rage, you know, and so it was. Everybody wanted perennials. Everybody wanted that kind of garden. And so that was a lot of the work that I did before I went back to grad school was actually putting perennial gardens in people's yards. That was one of my jobs. But yeah, so I would say I've seen that kind of morph in my career. I would say now that houseplants are all the rage. And I would say that vegetable gardening is way more popular, but houseplants, I mean, that's insane. It reminds me of like tulip mania way, way back hundreds of years ago.
Yeah. And there's so many more cultivated varieties of just common houseplants now. And I think, you know, COVID with the houseplants and the vegetable gardens, I think that really... in my opinion, just to sort of help that along.
Yeah. If we're talking about my career, so when I first started in CSU Extension in San Miguel Basin, I'm what they used to kind of call single agent. Like my office is staffed with me on and off through my years. We've had a 4-H coordinator and then we have an admin. So we're pretty remote. We're like an hour and a half from the two closest extension offices. So I can't, you know, we have the resources of CSU, right? And I had people to help me do programming that I wasn't knowledgeable about, like livestock programming. But I started this job right when local food, remember how that... local food, right when that got popular and I had done this... It was just beginning to be a thing that everybody talked about. And since we're so remote, you know, we're considered like a food desert. And so that was when I did a programming survey, that was what people wanted me to focus on. And so we'd done mostly local food programming. And then COVID hit, and everybody wanted to grow a vegetable garden. So for those of us that are horticulturists and at CSU, we had like this wonderful opportunity at the state level and at our local levels to come up with a lot of resources to help people. So it was exciting to be part of the beginnings of the local food movement in the area with other wonderful organizations. And it was exciting to be part of CSU Extension during COVID, something positive, right, that came out of
Right.
COVID.
Right. And you were on the team for the
Grow and
people
give.
grow and
Yeah.
give. Yeah, people
Yeah.
growing
Yeah.
in their own gardens, and I think there were several counties across the state that and they
Yeah.
still are and that's still continuing, and
Yeah.
I hope it keeps on going.
Yeah, that was a great collaborative project on the state level to do the Colorado Vegetable Growers Guide. And I got to contribute like high altitude information to that. And there's just a lot of resources on the Grow and Give that the team worked to put on that site. It's an amazing site. And the give portion of it is really cool too.
Yes, absolutely. And tell the folks about your graduate work. You did a drought study.
Yeah, so I went to grad school in 2002. So if you've lived in Colorado long, you know that that was one of the major drought years. And since then, there have been many, and there were before as well. But 2002 and Denver area put in all these watering restrictions, and they were talking about taking out lawns. And so the green industry was really concerned because we know how important green landscapes are, because they reduce your need to, like, they cool your surroundings. And so you don't have to use artificial cooling in your houses, So that's one of the benefits. There's many benefits. Trees areas have less crime. So, the green industry, we know all this stuff. And so we're really worried about it. And since I went to CSU, I was on the Front Range. And so because that was an issue, my graduate research project was a drought study where I grew 19 different of bedding plants, the most popular ones, the ones that sold the most, I guess you'd say. And then we put Kentucky bluegrass as one of our crops because we had to have a reference ET. I don't want to get too scientific. So we just grew different bedding plants at different levels of irrigation, and then we took data to see how they performed, at different levels of irrigation. And so what was really enlightening about that was that the Kentucky bluegrass itself performed, it would be green and growing and lush at 50% of the recommended amount of water for bluegrass. So that was interesting. But yeah, we had
Wow.
three sites. Those research beds looked like floral quilts.
Oh, wow. Yeah, like Holland in the bulb, with the bulb industry. Yeah.
But
Wow.
because we had each replication, there were five replications and five irrigations, so it'd be like 20 plants, like 500 plants randomized. And so it was so colorful. It was
Yes.
beautiful.
Yes. Like the CSU trial gardens,
Yeah, that's where it
for
was
yeah.
at Perk. Do you remember Perk?
Yes, I do. Yes.
Yes, there's a change in extension
Yes.
CSU. There is a stadium
Yes.
there now.
Yeah, I know. I know. Well, things move along and
They do. They do. Yeah.
expansion, yeah.
And
Yeah.
over by Spring Creek, those greenhouses and where they put a lot of the trees out of the arboretum, that's a really nice facility for sure.
Yeah,
So.
I think, I actually to do a little segue here. When I lived back in New York, I just bought a whole bunch of perennials or not perennials, annuals, and I put them in front of the front patio before the driveway, there was this open area, and I didn't know what I wanted to do, so I viewed a house, and it was this floral carpet of all these colors, and, you know, you couldn't see it from the roadway. You have to come up the drive. As soon as you got to the top of the drive, it would be like, wow. And I actually liked that more than anything, but, you know, in our times of drought, you know, you sort of, it's smarter to do like things with like things, and, you know, it's just healthy cultural practices. It always comes back to that.
Yeah.
Anyway.
I mean, in the research, you could group things, right? So right. I won't get into all the details, but, you know, depending on what irrigation level they perform the best at, you know, there were two annuals, I would just let you know, that performed just fine at 0 to 25%. And that was a white petunia, who'd have thunk? And then, you know, that imagination verbena?
Yeah.
Yeah, it looked better in the lower to no irrigation site in the beds than it did. It would flop and quit blooming in the highly irrigated areas. So yeah, it was very useful information. And I know that it was Welby Gardens. I'll go ahead and say that. I know that they still have continued similar research with other plants, and they have a brochure or at least one brochure.
Do you have that anywhere, that research that you could share with people still on your website, or is there a link of some sort? If not, maybe we could.
You know, it's a traditional thing, right? It's in the library. My thesis is in the library. I have copies of it. I've never posted it online. But Welby Gardens has a brochure. If anybody was interested, I'd love to share it. I have it in a digital.
Okay, well, maybe people should call your office. So.
Yeah, if they're interested. Yeah, and okay. Welby Gardens, too. And
Welby Gardens has a brochure?
Yeah, okay. They have a brochure. Okay. And I don't have a link to the brochure. I just have hard copies.
Okay. So how about the lawn debate? We have lawn care and We all want the perfect lawn, and we want less inputs, right? Right? You know,
right.
But by virtue of grass itself, it's high maintenance, right?
Right.
unless it's native.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say, you know, since I've been here, none of my master gardeners, very few of them were ever really interested in the lawn portions of the master gardener program. However, you know, I'm in the county with Telluride and Mountain Village, and there are lots of beautiful lawns in those areas. So it just, it matters, you know, what kind of like where you live, I guess. But, you know, ever since I've been here, it's that whole debate, you know, Kentucky bluegrass is of the devil and we have to use other things, you know, and that's wisdom, but also know that Kentucky bluegrass doesn't necessarily need as much water as we think it does. And like those communities that I just discussed, Telluride and Mountain Village, they're high elevation, so they're cool. So they're a better climate for cool season Kentucky bluegrass. So it's absolutely that whole right plant, right place thing, right?
Right.
Yeah. But at the same time, you know, people, I know in the UK they have no mow May. Have you heard about that?
Oh, absolutely. I did an article on that. Yeah.
And so, you know, I would say it's not as the concept and the ideal and people wanting less inputs, that is definitely a thing here, but we don't really do no-mow May that often. But what that means is you don't mow your lawn so that the pollinators have access to all the weeds and the dandelions and the good stuff in your lawn.
Right.
You know, yeah.
And I know that pollinator gardens has been a fad. When do you think that started?
Oh, that did start when I was in this job, because at first it was I won't give you the whole backstory, but I was like, what? All gardens are pollinator gardens. Like, I've never been in a garden where
Oh.
there weren't pollinators buzzing around.
Right.
And so, that was my first like response, because I'm like, oh my gosh, is this just a fad? But then I realized, we're all concerned with climate change and the extremes that that might bring, and we really don't know what it's going to bring, right? And so
Right.
there are native plants and native pollinators that have very specific relationships where they depend on each other for survival. So without the plant, you can't have the survival of the pollinator. Without the pollinator, you can't have the survival of the plant. And so that, I'm like, oh. So it's really more, I think the pollinator garden, the purpose of it that makes it important is those types of situations, right?
Well, and
And
it's the diversity too. It's the
right.
diversity, yeah. Like you had talked about the moths and the yucca plant, yeah. So, specific species to a specific species of yucca, it has to be there. They're interdependent upon each other.
And there's many instances of that, and so you want to make sure that you have enough native plants that bloom over a long period of time so that you are ensuring that native pollinators have native plants. And native pollinators, you may find them on a non-native plant. That's not the point, because those are more generalist pollinators, but it's still a good idea based on climate change and just balanced ecosystems to have a lot of native plants as well. And
Right.
something else that that brought into the gardening world is, okay, so now they recommend you don't cut back and clean up your gardens in the fall. You don't cut them back all the way because you want to leave stems for insects to lay eggs in, right? And
Right.
you don't clean up all the litter because some insects lay their eggs in that litter. And so we've always been taught, okay, you got to cut that back and then, to tidy it up, and you've got to clean out that litter so that you're not perpetuating the bad pests and the diseases that you don't want. So now it's like finding this balancing act. And I don't know about you, but we've got a couple gardens that we have research gardens that we have through the extension office. And so when we made that change where we weren't cutting everything back in the fall, sometimes in the spring you can forget, and then the plant regrows into the old stuff that may or may not fall out.
Right.
So, and then some people are like, well, you just have to be willing to have a more messy garden for pollinator gardens. But I think if you just change your mind shift and your management, you can have both.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. Well, that's cool. So now we're getting into, peat-free as far as soil mixes, right? And talking about biochar, that's really the next big thing.
I would just went to the conservation district did this program, and it was about composting, and one of the speakers was a professor from Colorado Mesa University in Grand Junction, and he does all this biochar research. And so then we had speakers on composting, and I learned that if you mix the biochar and the compost together, then they help each other. So like the compost will help the biochar to be activated, I guess. You know what I mean? Because the compost has the microorganisms in it. And then the biochar is, it helps the compost too. So I can't give you the whole scientific thing. I just thought it was like so interesting, you know, really interesting. And, you know, the biochar helps you to have that carbon sink and the compost, mixing the compost with the biochar increases that.
Right. And it's helping to, you know, peat.
Yeah.
Peat bogs are a very important ecosystem on their own. Right. And, you know, and you had mentioned
You're doing these great segues, right?
Yeah.
Because we were just talking about carbon sinks. And that is
why
peat, using peat for everything is not sustainable, or it's not wise, you know, to rely on peat so much, because it can take thousands of years for those peat bogs to form. And though peat bogs sequester more carbon than forests. And so that's why continuing to use peat on a large scale is not wise, you know. And so in the UK, they have a date, I think it's January 1st, 2026.
Wow.
That they're not going to use peat. So there's already all these peat-free mixes that you can buy. It'll take a while to get all the peat out of the system, you know, but yeah, we don't have anything like that in the US, but that is the goal for England and maybe other parts of Europe. So, you know, now we're learning about all these other things like coir, and, you know, most of the compost in the soil that we get that's peat-free is wood products. And I have mixed feelings or mixed success with that, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and we're just so reliant on peat. We have to learn the properties of the other ingredients in soilless media.
Well, I bought some smaller mums and I took them out of the pot, and there was peat. Their roots were in peat. There was no soil.
Yeah.
And so how do you sustain? Because when that peat dries out, it's like hard as concrete.
This is another change. I do this in our high and dry garden. So I don't remember who recommended it, but it's either Denver Botanical Gardens or other people, but they recommend rinsing that off of the roots of the plants before you plant. It's so freaky. And when I ask my master gardeners to do that when we plant in our display gardens, they're like, what? But we've had some plant loss, but we don't have what you would think, you know, putting it into the soil and you don't have that soil interface
Right. Absolutely. And then, you know, we're also looking at, it's not necessarily a new fad, it's been around for a few years, reducing the use of plastics and other forms of regenerative gardening, not to mention regenerative agriculture.
Yeah.
And methods of planting a tree have come a long way.
I know, and it's so slow. I've seen it so slow for the landscapers to change. You know, when I first came, I did the site visit. They had planted these giant spruce. And it was spring and they were looking really bad. Well, they were planted too deeply. They were in the balls with the burlap and the wire, and they had these, I don't know, 12-inch high rims. You know, what do you call that? What do we call? I can't remember what we used to call that, because we used to say you put that saucer.
The saucers.
Saucer.
Okay.
And you put the, you know, so they would build the soil up, and there was water, like 6-inch to 12-inch deep water from the snow melt, just sitting in those areas. And so I was like, you need to, you know, remove what soil you can off the top. It's a little bit too late to remove, but remove what wire and stuff you can, and knock down those berms. That's what they're called, berms. I still see people do that. And if you tell them, they're like, what? But they're going to dry out. They need the water, you know?
It's more about, educating, which is what we do in extension, and getting them to understand how does a tree grow? How does a tree, survive? And looking at its structure. Yeah.
And
Wow.
those roots
Wow.
need to get out. You
Yeah.
know, they don't. But anyway, it's a slow change because the research is definitely there on how to plant a tree. And Allison, you know, within CSU Extension, she's like so knowledgeable and, you know, did a lot of research on that. And I love to hear her teach anything for that matter,
Yes,
but
yes.
she really does a good job with the tree stuff. But
Well,
if you plant them like she recommends, you're gonna have way more success.
yep, absolutely. She has a lot of passion for trees. So do I. We,
Well, cool. I
So is
like
there,
all plants. It
well,
doesn't
I
matter.
do too. I do too, but I'm out in a rural area where they really depend on the trees to shade and cool and survival and protection and build the ecosystems up and it's just as important anywhere in the state of Colorado. The biggest thing is green corridors now, as much green as you to cool and shade and provide oxygen, and trees are part of the hydrology system. Without them, it will not rain, and that's a big thing to consider. Anyway, we get a lot of hail damage out here, but who doesn't across the state of Colorado? And it's amazing how they can survive and
Most of the
continue.
trees. Yeah, oh, I'm sorry.
That's
I'm
okay.
sorry.
So yeah,
It is amazing they can survive out there.
that's, I know, yes, okay. Well, we're getting 60 mile an hour winds today, so coming,
Oh,
so
great.
yeah, oh, lovely.
Most of our
But
trees are
it's,
native. Like most of the trees that people plant in their yard, they're either a native species like a spruce or an aspen. And of course, there's way more choices, but most of the trees that people plant besides those are small trees like crab apples and junipers. I'm trying to
Right,
think.
right.
So most of this career I've been spent has been spent diagnosing problems on native trees because a lot of people, you know, they build a house in kind of a rural area, so there's all these native trees that are there, and you know, that's something we've seen a lot is, you know, we had sudden aspen decline not long after I came here, and we didn't know at that point if the aspens were regenerating. You know, and then we've had so many drought episodes that we have. After you have drought, then the years after that, you have insect outbreaks. So we've had pine beetles and we've had diseases. We've had root rot on our spruce and our poor native trees. This
Yeah,
year it's
that's
the
true.
oaks and the aspens again.
Oh boy. Well, things go in cycles. Things go, one cycle to the next. So, is there anything else you'd like to share before we?
I can't think of anything, you know. I can't think of anything right now.
What's the one thing that you have taken the most pride in doing over your career?
Over my career. It was really fun being involved in like local food things and to do programs that were really well received. Like people loved our greenhouse programs. We did apple grafting and pruning classes because we've got these remnants of historic orchards in the area. And so that inspired some people to start a nonprofit called the AppleCore Project, where they map the orchards that we have, and then they take cyan wood and graft it and sell trees. That's one of the things that they do to support themselves. But it also means that we have all these really cool genetics of all these old varieties that we can plant in the area. So that was super fun to be involved in. And then personally, I discovered my love of seeds and seed saving through this job. Yeah. And we started a seed library at the request of one of our local libraries. And yeah, personally for me has been a lot of personal development through seeds.
And so what was the name of the orchard program again?
It's called the Apple Core Project.
Apple Core Project. Is that still going on?
Yeah. Wow. They have a website. So something fun, the last thing that I get to do that's a program for work, I will retire. My last day is October 7th. So on October 5th, there's a heritage festival in Nuclea, Colorado, and the Apple Core sponsors that with the Historical Society of the area. And so they make fresh pressed cider. There's lots of vendors. There's music. The Apple Core sets up a display of all these heirloom varieties of apples, and you can do a tasting, and they sell trees. And then what we do is we do a produce show. So it's sort of like the fair, right? But you take,
right.
We want local people to bring their produce to the produce show. And then we judge it. We judge it live. And we don't judge it by comparing apples to apples and tomatoes to tomatoes. We judge the produce based on the variety characteristics and the quality. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. That sounds like a lot of fun. Wow.
It is. Wow. So
what a way to go. What a way to retire, right?
I know. That's what I was going to say. That's really fun. Yeah.
Good. Well, thank you, Yvette.
Thank you.
A thank you to the audience for listening. Tune in next time when we get to the heart of the matter on another horticultural topic.